It's great once again to see everyone, and we certainly appreciate the fact that you have chosen to be with us this evening as we continue our thoughts on the home and how that we can strengthen our families and we can strengthen our relationships with each other. And by doing so, of course, we can strengthen our relationship with the Lord. We've already stated in a couple of lessons in the past that, if our home life is not effective and our home life is not what it should be, then that will affect every other area of our lives. This will be my last night in this meeting, and I certainly appreciate the fact that you have had me here, and I appreciate the fact that we have had such good attendance, and I thank you for your hospitality. We've been treated like kings, and, we're a small army to kind of take in, so it's not easy for somebody just to take all four of us in, and so we require a lot of time, and Brother Allen has taken off a couple of days from work to be with us, and we certainly appreciate that. And we've made some great friends, and we look forward to the time we can see you again. This evening, we're going to continue our thoughts and our study, but we're going to turn to a thought that is very difficult for us to be able to achieve. James warns us about it, gives us instruction on how to do it, and it is something that is totally against our nature, and that's forgiveness. Forgiveness is something that is completely against our nature in the fact that it's easier and more desirable for us to be able to retaliate than it is to forgive. And it's very difficult if you truly know what forgiveness is. And I've counseled a couple, and I got to see what it was, forgiveness, and trying to teach it and trying to get it over to somebody and make them understand it. And it comes to the point that he was just going to have to forgive, and he said, I can't. And I told him, I said, forgiveness is a choice. It's not whether you can or whether you can't. It's whether you will or whether you won't. I finally got it through his head. And then he finally said, well, I won't. And that's a different story. You see, but what we want to start off with is the fact that love is a choice, and hate is also a choice. And hate is generally a result of unforgiveness, and it turns into many, many things. But the bottom line is the fact that unforgiveness destroys our lives. If you're the type of person that will not forgive, and now, see, we're going to get a lot of confusion going on, because a lot of times we feel like that we have to forget an issue in order to have forgiveness. That's not the case at all. You don't find that through the Bible. Matter of fact, the guy leading the prayer there mentioned the fact that we were to pray for our enemies. Why do you think Christ asked us to pray for our enemies? I mean, it's kind of odd, isn't it? You realize that if we truly live by this, especially as Christians, if we lived halfway by it, the divorce rates among us would be almost nothing because of the fact that, forgiveness is what God has called us to do. It's hard to understand, but, when the Lord puts you in a position to where you are called to forgive, the harder it is to forgive, the more you can see how God loves you and how it is that He loves us and what He had to overcome in order to be able to accept us back into His fellowship and the life that He gave on the cross to be able to pay for that sin. So in our lives, when we encounter problems, Christ said there's going to be plenty of people that are going to throw stumbling blocks in front of you. So we have to deal with that. It's not so much what the world does to us, but how we react when the world does it. Or maybe it's a brother, maybe it's a sister, maybe it's your husband or your wife. And of course, this is a family-oriented series, so we're going to be centered on that. But of course, forgiveness will apply to any and every aspect of our life. The main thing you need to know about forgiveness or non-forgiveness is it's all for us. The Bible teaches us in order for us to receive forgiveness from the Lord, we have to be able to forgive. But the reason He encourages us to do that and forces us actually to do that is because it's for our emotional health. We talked about that. We discussed some of those aspects last night. Sometimes in our relationship with our wives or our husbands or our friends and brothers and sisters, we have problems. And, if you haven't had problems in your life yet and somebody hasn't offended you, then you're either very secluded or you're very young, because it will happen. And so you're going to either have to deal with it one of two ways. You have to learn to forgive and know what forgiveness is. The concept of forgiveness is very easy. To implement it is quite something else. And, God calls us to forgive for various reasons. And tonight we're going to look at some of the reasons why we choose not to forgive. And we're going to look at what forgiveness is not in order to be able to better understand what it is. Sometimes it helps us to understand what it is not, certain aspects of things, to help us understand what it really is, to get some of those misconceptions out of our head. So if you've ever said, I just can't forgive, you can't say that because forgiveness is a choice. Love is a choice. And we're going to look at 1 Corinthians chapter 13 here in a second. But before you turn to that, if you will, turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 2. And Paul is talking about an issue here that has happened among the church there at Corinth in his second letter that we have, the record that he wrote. He's addressing a particular issue, and we don't really know what that particular issue is. There's been a problem. But the whole idea of this first part of this chapter is about forgiveness. Now, I told you to begin with that this life we live is a spiritual conflict. The Bible warns us of that, and you can see it all the way through. And if you believe in the spirit world, I'm sure you do, you wouldn't be here this evening if you didn't. You know, how does it interact, and how do we work into the picture? So it is it's a spiritual conflict that we face with all of our relationships, and especially, of course, that of our marriages. But Paul says in verse 10, he comes down to this, and he's been discussing, if you want to go back and read at your own leisure, starting with verse 1, you'll see that he's talking about an offense that's happened, and so forgiveness is what he's talking about. In the verse 10, he says, to whom ye forgive anything, I forgive also, for if I forgave anything, to whom I forgave it, for your sakes I forgave it, in the personage of Christ. He says, whoever you forgive, I'm going to forgive as well, and I'm going to do it in the view of Christ, so that, and openly, so people will understand, and so that I can be, so that he can stand forgiven as well. Verse 11 is what we want to look at. Now, he is drawing all this to a conclusion about forgiveness, and he says in verse 11, lest Satan. In other words, if you choose not to do this, if you choose not to forgive, and unforgiveness is going to be your route of your course of action, he says Satan will get an advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices. Another version renders that, in order that Satan might not outwit us, for we are not unaware of his schemes. You see, the Bible is very plain and pointing out to us that the devil will work in our lives however we let it. You see, and I'm sorry to say, he knows what we know, and it doesn't take long even for you to hang around me and to see my weaknesses. They'll show up pretty easily. Satan has nothing better to do, especially for those of us that are members of the church, and he wants to destroy our credibility among those that would be listening to us, to hang around and find out our weaknesses, and he just licks his chops when he finds out that we are an unforgiving person, because he has an avenue there. We have just given him an invitation into our lives on a silver platter, because he can do so much with that. And thankful to us, as far as he's concerned, we're going to spread this damage, because we're not a forgiving person. We're going to hold everything everybody's ever done against us, and we're going to use it against them at the opportune time and be able to throw it back, because that's the reason we hold grudges in the first place, is so we can have artillery in the time that we need it, to be able to bring somebody else down to our level when we get caught at something or somebody points their finger. We'll have this artillery stored on everybody and say, don't bring that up on me. Remember when you did this, that, and the other? How many times have you ever done that in your marriage? That's a destructive thing, you know. And it's hard not to do. James, we're going to read James. He warns us against that. And he warns us about the destructiveness of it. And it is definitely not healthy for our relationships, but it's the hardest thing not to do. Because when we're offended, we want everybody to know about it. Because we like to look the victim. And we like to look hurt. And we like to show our strength in enduring this thing that's been done to us. And we want to point it out to everybody in the world. You see, Christ said you can't do that. God said that he is the one that takes vengeance. And when we decide to retaliate ourselves, all we're saying is the fact that, Lord, I don't think you're doing your job. I'm going to step in here, and I think I can do better at this than you. You see, because we like to see people hurt that hurt us. That's why we retaliate. That's why we hold grudges. That's why we throw things up to them every time we have the opportunity. Or anything goes wrong, we've got this storage closet full of things that people's done to us in our lives. And I'm sure you know people like that, and God forbid that we be one of them. Because it's destructive to us. Because when we're unforgiving, it affects every area of our life. And we shouldn't be that way. God doesn't want things dragging us down. Paul says cast off the weight that so easily besets us, and sometimes this is one of them. So we're going to begin to look at this, but before we start, turn with me, if you will, to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And most of us know this very well as the love chapter, and that it is. Paul starts out talking about the fact that charity, as the King James renders it, or love, is more important, because love is the root of what we do, or what we don't do, you see. So, the Bible teaches that you can see the fruits of the Spirit, and those things are peace and joy and so on and so forth. So if you ever wonder if you are growing in the Spirit, if you're growing in your religion, if you're growing in godliness, then look at the things in your life. Look at the fruit. He's given us those, and He's pointed them out so that we can see where we stand and how we've matured and how we've moved along. How is joy and peace and love in your life? How do you react when people do things to you? Do you hold a grudge? Do you try to retaliate? These are signposts that we can use to see where we've made it to. To see where we need to go and see where we come from. You know, we always should judge ourselves by ourselves and not by other people. I've been discouraged in times past because I look at other people and I think, God, I'll never be like that. You know, I'll never get to that point. You see, but that's not fair on myself, and it's not fair to you if you do it to yourself. You'll never judge yourself by other people. Yes, they should be a good standard and something that you should aim for and try to achieve, but judge yourself from yourself. Where did you start, and where are you at, and where should you be, and so on and so forth. And the fruits of the Spirit is given to us, or at least pointed out to us, so that we can use them as signposts as to where we've got in our growth in our Christianity. So, Paul starts out by telling us that we speak in tongues of angels and so on and so forth, and he talks about prophecies because in verse chapter 12 he just got to talking about spiritual gifts. And he's trying to point out to them that love and this that the act of love is what should drive all these things, and that should be our focus. And then, in verse 5, he says, he's speaking about love, of course, and does not behave itself unseemingly, speaketh not her own, is not easily provoked. Now, that particular part of that verse, the next part of it is in response to that. And it says, first of all, is not easily provoked, and thinketh no evil. Another rendering of that is not easily angered and keeps no records of wrong. Now that's exactly what we want to talk about. And that's what unforgiveness is keeping a record of wrongs. Well, why would we do that? Well, I've already told you. The only reason we keep a record of wrongs now, or I'm going to flip that around just in a second, we also keep records of our rights. Which is the same exact purpose, you know. You think, that doesn't mean you shouldn't be proud of what you've accomplished or thankful for the ability to accomplish it, but we shouldn't store up our records of right so that we can say, I told you so. Told you I could do that better than you. Told you. Look at what I did. Look at how I did this. You see, it's basically the same thing as pointing out someone else's wrong. But then he says that it keeps no records of wrong. Now, that's what we want to talk about, is how we keep our records of wrongs, and why we fail to forgive. And I've already told you, you know, the Lord is wonderful in teaching us things, and it's not easy sometimes how He goes about it exactly. And I've had an experience in the past few months that, you know, with myself and another person was involved in. And I had a wonderful opportunity to put my money where my mouth is, because, you know, I've been teaching this along. And I got me an experience that was just something else. And I thought, I guess the Lord wants to see if I'm willing to do what I've been talking about. So I got the wonderful opportunity to find out what forgiveness is and what it really means and the blessings that can come by it. I've said many times that the Lord asked us to do what He asked us in order for us to be blessed. And for our benefit, every single thing. When, you know, when He tells us to respond to the gospel, that's for our benefit. You realize that. He don't want us to be lost, and He created us and loves us. And we're going to, if we get time, look at a chapter to show you how much God really, really loves us. And we're going to explore that if we can. So we need to move along. And we're going to try to tonight expose what forgiveness really is. First of all, so that when you encounter things, and I don't mean if you encounter, when you encounter things that you have to forgive, first of all, remember, forgiveness is for your emotional health. You cannot and should not live in a way that you wake up from day to day and you are worried about or concerned about or thinking about constantly what someone has done to you and how you're going to get it back or how you're going to pay it back or what you wish would happen to this person. You can't live like that. It consumes your thoughts, and we shouldn't have to live that way, and God certainly doesn't want us to. And when He asks us to forgive, it's based on those very reasons. But He does that because He wants us to live emotionally well. So let's look at some reasons that why we choose not to forgive. Now, I'm going to get to it in a minute, and I'm going to explain to you, it is a choice. You choose not to forgive, you choose to love, or you choose to hate. It's all in how you look at it, how you approach it, and the choices that you make. And that's the same way with God, by the way, and He did choose to love us. First of all, by being unforgiving, we seek to gain control. And this happens in our relationships, especially in our families and in our spouses, but in any situation, because we store up this pile of wrongs that anybody's done to you. And I've seen people that are just looking for something wrong because they don't have anything on you just yet, and they want something in the event that they ever need to fire it back, you see. So they store up these wrongs so that in the event that they get in a situation that something is pointed out to them, they can use it back against you to gain control of a situation, or at least bring the wind out of it, you see. That's why we're warned, or we're given instruction by Timothy, or at least Paul gives instruction to Timothy, that in order for us to be leaders of the church as men, that, you know, people shouldn't be able to point their finger at us and say, well, look at what you've done. That doesn't mean we've never made a mistake, but that does mean that we've taken care of it, everybody's aware of it, and we've moved past that, because you can't correct somebody and then turn right around to you and say, yeah, but what about this area in your life? You see? It just brings down any kind of correction that you've got. So we store those up for the time that we might be corrected, or someone might find some fault in us, and we can use it back at them, and we can demean their character. You realize that's what gossip is all about. Gossip is just, people that hold grudges or like to spread things, and many times it's half-truths, and half-truths are worse than lies, by the way, because there is a portion of truth there, but that portion of truth that is given is designed to make someone change their view about someone. You see, there's a little bit of truth there, but it's just enough truth given to be able to distort. And it's far worse, as far as I'm concerned, than a lie. A half-truth is no truth at all. So, as we move on, we seek to gain control of the situation. And the only reason we keep them and store them is because we intend to use them. In other words, if you didn't intend to use it, you wouldn't keep it. You see what I'm saying? So this should tell us a lot about our demeanor and our character, and probably tell us a lot about how we stand before the Lord. Because if we're storing up, we intend to use. I mean, there's no point in hoarding up things if we don't intend to use them. So when we harbor ill feelings towards someone and we retain those things, it's for a purpose. And that purpose is the time that we're going to need them and the time that we can fire those things back to be able to destroy someone's character. And we use these as weapons in various ways with the intent to pay back, this is important, to pay back for real, that is something that actually happened, or imagined, or thought hurts. If you ever had someone misunderstand the situation and they become hurt by it emotionally, and what really happened was not what happened at all. And if they just knew the truth about the situation, they wouldn't even feel the way they do. But that doesn't change the fact. You see, even if a person imagines or misconstrues something, they're still hurt. So the problem for that person is the same. They still have to deal with it, whether it's imagined or whether it's real. You see, imagining that I misunderstand the situation and I've become hurt about it, and rather than following the biblical guideline and confronting someone and bringing it to their attention and finding out the truth about it and moving on, then I just move back and I begin to harbor these feelings, and the more I think about it, the worse it gets, and, you know, and I begin to tell somebody and so on and so forth, and we move along in that way. And this means also we like to look the victim. You know, certain people in certain times, you know, we like to look pitiful. We want to seem to everyone else, because this is how we want to appear. So we use these things, and you find you tell people about it, and all that does is brings their character down. But the reason for you telling it is to try to lift your character up, you see, so that we can look the victim, so that we can have pity from people. I know people that live like that. They just love to use pity as something that they strive on in order to be able to look the victim. So, and another thing, when we look the victim, you see, we don't have to take responsibility for what we've done. You know, usually there's a two-way street when it comes to a problem. There's usually two different attitudes going on there. So as long as we can keep the focus off of us, then sometimes that keeps us from owning up to what we've done and taking responsibility for it. That's what happened in the Garden of Eden, you see. Adam passed it on. We discussed that, I believe it was Sunday. And the reason for that is they believed that lie. They believed the lie that they were going to be like God. And that they felt they should be, and they said, hey, if there's anything wrong, and obviously there is something wrong, but it's not my fault. I didn't do it. It was her. And it was, you know, really it resorts back to you, God, because you created the both of us, and you gave her to me as a helper, and look at the situation you got me in. You see, he felt that he ought to be perfect. And sometimes we feel we ought to be. We strive to be, and we can't, and because we can't, we get discouraged, and the little circle goes around and around. And so, we use these things to make ourselves look like a victim. We use these things to make, sometimes, just to keep us from having to stand up to the responsibility of accepting for what we've done. So, we talked about the fruits of righteousness. Now, there's also fruits of unforgiveness, by the way. You should be able to see them in your life, or if that is the case, not see them. But unforgiveness causes resentment. And this is fuel for the fire, is all it is. And we're warned and given instructions, again, to stay away from this, and we're going to look at James in just a second, and I'm going to explain to you what it is. Unforgiveness causes us to be resentful, and resentment is repressed anger. You know, you think, I'm not going to say anything, I'm not going to tell anybody, I'm not going to do anything, and the more you think about it, the madder you get. And I know you can probably pull up 100 scenarios in your life, but if you think about it long enough, you're just fighting mad, gritting your teeth. That's resentment. You know, that's what unforgiveness does. That's what it forces you to have to live with, is those type of feelings and those type of thoughts day in and day out, and it tortures us for absolutely no reason. And God doesn't want us to live that way, and I don't think you want to live that way. Oh, I don't. Resentment turns into rage. It's a snowball effect. The longer we hang on to it, the worse it gets. It's just like getting a bull with horns, you know. You're in a bad situation, but when you turn him loose, you're going to be in a worse situation. And that's what happens. It just snowballs. Ephesians chapter 4, Paul teaches us there as he is writing to us that we shouldn't, nothing wrong with being angry, he says. I know you've read these verses. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 26. He tells us that there's nothing wrong with being angry. As a matter of fact, Christ made a rope out of cords and whipped them all in the temple and ran them out. So it wasn't wrong with being angry. It's how you handle it. He says, be angry and sin not. Don't let the sun go down on your anger, on your wrath. He gives us warning there. The longer you hang on to this thing, the worse it's going to get. It's going to be like a cancer, and it will literally eat you from the inside out. He says, don't hang on to it. Make restitution with the adversary quickly, he says. Why? Because you give place to Satan when you don't. And we force ourselves. You see, what we do to ourselves, it's just unbelievable. We were talking about that today. Our minds are funny things. You know, when we hang on to this, we think we're going to hang on to it and get restitution. And what we do is hang on to it and make ourselves miserable. And sometimes we don't even realize it. And that's an awful way to have to live. He says in the second, in verse 27, same pattern he follows when he was talking to the church at Corinth. Neither give place to the devil. Don't let your sun go down on your anger, because when you do, you're harboring ill feelings, and those ill feelings will turn into resentment, and that resentment will turn into rage, and rage will drive you insane. It'll drive you to do some of the stupidest things you've ever done. Have you ever done anything you're proud of when you're angry? Probably not. It's not a way to be. But, nevertheless, this is when you have a problem, and you choose not to clear it up, because see, these are choices. He says, don't let your tongue go down on your wrath, because when you do, you're going to give place to the devil. You're going to let him stick the foot right in the door. And that's one of the greatest avenues. And I know full well that every one of you can think about times that this type of thing has destroyed families and churches and communities and congregations and families and so on and so forth. Because people won't turn things loose. You've heard of the Hatfields and McCoys, haven't you? We live right up next door to where they are. You see, this went off. It's that same type of thing. Sometimes we act like the Hatfields and McCoys, even in our churches. And in our families. What forgiveness is not, by the way. And this, I think, is fairly important. It's not forgetting it happened, because God gave us a memory, and we have a memory, and we're not going to forget certain things. I think we get confused because the Bible tells us that God remembers our sin no more. That's a rendering that means God doesn't hold against us any longer the penalty for what our sin was, you see. But when he says he doesn't remember it anymore, we get the idea that we're supposed to forget it, and if it ever comes to mind, that means I haven't forgiven. The Bible doesn't mean that God cannot remember what you've done. It means that he doesn't hold you responsible for it. He's not going to impute judgment as a result of that sin. That's what he means by it. He doesn't remember it any longer. Doesn't mean he's blocked it out of his memory and he can't call it up. That's not what he's saying. And it's not what it means for us. Doesn't mean that we have to forget that an event ever happened. Let me tell you, somebody hurts you deeply and scars you for life emotionally, you're not going to be able to forget that event. And if you think forgetting that event constitutes forgiveness, you're going to live with that all of your life because you can't forget it. You know, you lose a child in an accident, to a drunk driver, or whatever the case. You know, something horrible. You can't forget that. That's something you cannot get past, and you never will forget it. Nor probably should we forget it. It doesn't mean you can't forgive. It doesn't mean you shouldn't forgive. And for your emotional well-being, you have to forgive. And if you choose not to, then Satan will wreak havoc in your life as a result of it. Not looking, overlooking it or letting it slide. I've heard it say many times, people, offend you. Oh, that's just the way they are. It doesn't make any difference. You know, they have offended, and that offense still stands. And now I'm forced to have to do something with it, and just saying that these people are the way they are doesn't help the situation. You see, just how I am. That's just the way I am. You know, overlook it. Overlook that person. That's just the way they are to everybody. It doesn't mean you haven't been hurt. And that doesn't mean you haven't been left with feelings that you're going to have to deal with one way or the other. And you'll have two choices. One of them is start the act of forgiving or start the act of storing up offenses. And if you store up offenses, guaranteed, all you're doing is waiting for the time that you can fire right back. Why? To get restitution. To pay this person back. To make this person feel like you felt when you got hurt. That's all you do it for. If you have ill feelings in your heart tonight as a result of something somebody's done to you, you are just waiting for the opportunity to be able to shoot them back. Otherwise, you wouldn't have them. That's all there is to it. You lack some of the fruits of the Spirit. We lack the ability to not store up wrongdoing, not to store up ill feelings. Also, it's not out of our control. You know, it's not a lot of things, but it certainly isn't out of our control. You know, because, again, I've heard people say, and I have been guilty of it in the past myself, I just can't forgive. You cannot say that. I'm going to explain that to you why that is the case right now. Forgiveness involves three different things. If you have a pencil and you're interested in this, I'd like for you to write these down. If you can accomplish these three avenues in forgiveness, you can feel assured that you have accomplished what God would consider forgiveness. I don't care how many times it comes to your mind. I don't care how many times the feeling comes back. How many times you think about it and get angry. If you can accomplish the three things that we're fixing to mention, then you can feel assured that you have forgiven. And I don't care how you feel about it, you can feel certain that that's the case, and you stand vindicated in the sight of God. First of all, don't mention it to anyone. That's a terribly hard thing to do. That is extremely hard to do. Because the first thing we want to do, you see, if we take away the ability to tell everybody what somebody's done to us, then we have just stripped ourselves of the ability to be able to vindicate ourselves. We have just torn every possibility away of bringing this person's character down because of what they've done to us. And we can't, now you can still store up bad feelings, but you just can't tell anybody. That's the bad thing. You know, and what's the point in storing them if you can't tell them to anybody? You see, this is a circular reasoning here that works very well, and it gets you past some of the hardest things you'll ever have to deal with in your life. I have a little bit of an experience with that. Not mention it to the person again. Second thing. First of all, you don't tell another soul. Now, except in times that you have been hurt to the point that you need counseling. and you need to seek out a biblical counselor, one that will you can confide in and can trust in. Tell that person alone, instruct them to tell no one else about it, because I want to tell you why you can't tell anybody. And that's the last one we want to talk about. You don't tell anyone unless you have to have counseling, and at times that's the case. You don't bring it up to the person ever again, except to confront them if that be the case, and tell them what's going on, and tell them that you're in the process of forgiveness. Don't mention it to them again, ever, for any reason, because this is part of that payback. You see, every time you get around somebody, I've done my life like this, and I tell you, I feel awful for doing it, when I look back and see what possible things I could have done. You know, you store up all these little things. I remember things back 20 years ago, you know, and I had them in the back of my mind because, you know, I wanted to use them. For the times that, you know, she got ahead of me in the argument, because all it was about was really winning the argument. It wasn't about settling anything. It was about who's to win the argument. You know, and you depended on how bad the argument got as to how deep into your little black bag you had to reach and pull something out. You know, and it just keeps getting worse and worse, and she's doing the same thing. Before long, we said things that we would have never said and that we can never get over. You know, you can say I'm sorry all you want, but you can't take back words. It's already said. I'll give you a good example of that. Have you ever watched, and I've never really seen it in person, so I always have to see it on TV. Man, I can be that way. See the lawyer walking around there, you know, and he'll say something that he knows full well that the judge is going to make him strike from the records. But he's already planted it in the jury's mind. Doesn't matter if it's stricken off the records, and you go back and read the court records on it, and you won't see what he said, but it's in the jury's mind. You can say, I'm sorry, all you want. And that sometimes is all we can do and show that we've forgiven. But it doesn't change the fact that we said it. It doesn't change the fact that we've done the damage. It's already there. So, one and first and second thing, we don't mention it to the person any longer. Don't bring it up. Every time you get around them, you can't throw it up. And let me tell you, Carl, you're going to have to grit your teeth, almost sew your lips shut to keep from having to do this, because that's the natural reaction. Is to throw it up to this person and tell everybody that comes along, because we want to look like the victim. We want to look like we've been hurt. We want people to know what's been done so we can hurt this person back and make them feel like we did. You see, that's the whole purpose in the first place, is being able to retain these things. Here's the last one, and it's not pondering on it. It doesn't mean you can't think about it, because when certain things happen to us, we can't help but think about it. But what I'm talking about is sitting and thinking about it, stewing on it. The longer you think about it, and I can still think about this event and certain other events, and I can just get red in the face mad. And the longer I think about it, the madder I get, the madder I get, the more I want to do something about it, and the more I want to do something about it, the more I'm tempted to tell somebody about it. Because that's my only resource, is to be able to tell somebody. Some people break down and shoot people. But outside of that, I'm talking about verbally destroying somebody. And we can do that. So if you can accomplish these three things, not mentioning it to the person again, outside of the fact that you need to straighten up the situation, but after that, not telling anyone else except the counselor if you have to. And listen, let me warn you about that, because you're going to be tempted to tell a counselor just because you want to unload it and just because you want to get it off your chest. And now, that, if that's the case, you know, if it's something you can't handle, you need to seek counseling. If it is, and you're just seeking counseling because you want to tell somebody that, that's a whole different story. Because James warns us that when we really think we're just wanting to unload something, the more you talk about it, the worse it gets. Actually, what we do is, well, let's read James, if you will. James chapter 3. Verses 5 and 6. And he warns us, and he's already, and the first few verses there gives us examples of how small things can change large situations. In verse 5, and he said, even the tongue is that way. It's a little member, and it boasts great things, and behold how great a matter a little fire can kindle. That's what he's talking about. Sometimes we think we want to unload and we just want to get something off our chest, and what we do is set something on fire and it ends up becoming a raging inferno and it burns what's left of us inside. That's what happens when you tell people what somebody has done to you. Because let me give you a scenario. Let's say you make a mistake or somebody hurts you. And first thing you do, you'll run and tell everybody about it until you feel halfway vindicated. You get these people feeling like you're the victim and this person has done you horribly. Then, a few weeks later, you decide that was a mistake. You should have forgiven this person. You know, this was the wrong course of action, and you're going to stop, and you're going to take these things here that we're talking about, and from this point on, you're going to implement these things. Well, the first time you see somebody that you've told about it, they're going to say, can you believe what he done to you? How did that work? What happened about that? And you can't get it out of your mind because everybody in the country knows about it, and they're going to bring it up to you every time they see you. And so you can't quit pondering it. So even if you want to, you can't quit. You know, you get it out of your mind and you think, I'm not going to think about this because it only makes the situation worse. And the first time you see somebody you told, they bring it right back up. You can't get it out of your mind. And the more you think about it, the worse it gets. You see? So you can't stop it. It just grows and gets worse. And, you know, you need to quit thinking about it in order to forgive this person, but you can't. Because you told everybody in the world and they keep throwing it back up to you. If you had never said a word to nobody, nobody would remind you of it. And you wouldn't have to be thinking about it. And when you wasn't thinking about it, you could get over it quicker. And when you could get over it quicker, you could get it behind you and you could feel better and you could move on with your life. You see what happens? Every time we step out of God's will and we step out of doing what He asked us to do and told us to do, we make a mess. Every time. It never fails. Verse 6 says, the tongue is a fire full of iniquity, and the tongue is so set among them. Underline that if you write in your Bibles, that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature, and is set on fire in hell. He says, our tongue is so arranged among us that we use it in a way that it comes back to destroy our whole body. It causes us anguish. James says, if you can control your tongue, you will have mastered the art of forgiveness. It's one of the worst things we face, I can guarantee you. I have a serious problem with it. Now, I don't have problems. I'm not afraid to tell you about them because you need to pray for me and vice versa. We face these problems. And it's hard not to do because the first thing we want to do and all we can do to retaliate and to vindicate ourselves is to be able to throw it back or to tell somebody and drag this person down and make them look bad in everybody's eyes and hopefully that'll make us look better. Because that's our intent. So, in our last thoughts, when we totally forgive, total forgiveness is just absolutely refusing to hold bad feelings against someone. And if you accomplish what we just got through talking about, you can't. Now, I'll tell you, and this is not patting myself on the back, by the way. This is telling you that the Lord taught me a lesson because He gave me the ability to be able to see what I'm talking about here. And I can speak from a standpoint of on the other side. Because it's been, honestly, this last event that happened 6 months ago, I guess. I have never accomplished the three things we just talked about. I've never been able to do that. I've never been able to keep my mouth shut to the point that nobody else knew about what happened. And it's always come back to haunt me because I still have people reminding me, bringing up certain situations that happened forever ago. And that only fuels that fire again. But when you don't tell nobody, and you're the only person in the world that knows about it, you forget it fairly quickly. It's amazing. And a fairly traumatic event. And you forget it. Why? Because there's really nobody reminding you of it. And it's only you. And as long as you don't ponder on it and sit around and think about how you're going to get them back, and you can manage those three things, you'd be amazed at how fast you'll be able to drop the idea, forget it, get it out of your memory at least. And what I mean by that is to not think about it all the time. You know, for the first 3 days when this happened, I couldn't sleep. I couldn't go to sleep. First of all, then when I did go to sleep, the first thing I thought about when I woke up was that event. It kept going through my mind. You know, and you have these little scenarios that go through our mind, and we think about what we're going to tell this person when we see them. We think about what we're going to tell everybody that we see about them. And these things go through our mind, and the longer they go, the worse it gets. And the more you think about it, the more apt you are to tell somebody about it. Because when you keep rehashing those situations and you keep thinking about how you're going to tell this person about what this person done to you, the more you think about it, the more likely you are to do it. So the quicker we can get it out of our head, and stop thinking about it, the quicker we'll be able to forgive. So forgiveness is not forgetting. Forgiveness is accomplishing those three things we just talked about. Try it the next time it happens to you. I can assure you, if you can accomplish those three things, then you can, because they're all choices, you know. Love is a choice, and hate is a choice. When you choose not to love, then you automatically choose to hate. You begin to store these things for the time that you can use them against this person. They're both choices. So don't tell me you can't. And don't ever say, I just can't forgive. Because you can't. You just don't want to. Because when we choose to forgive, we give up all the rights that we have to be able to pay this person back. And that we can't stand that sometimes. We don't want to do that. We want to step in and we want to say, Lord, I don't think you're doing a good job of this. I'm going to start paying these people back by saying, you know, I'm going to give them what they deserve. I'm going to make them hurt just like I did. And we spend the rest of our lives. And if it ain't this person, it's going to be that person. And there's always somebody there. As a matter of fact, if you get good at it, you can handle four or five of them at one time. You pay them back everybody you see. And it becomes an art. Let me tell you, it takes a lot to be able to juggle that kind of anger. You're going to be the kind of person that's going to blow up on somebody. And that's not a good situation to be in. I want to close with a chapter in the Bible that has become one of my favorites. Not that they're all not good, but you have particular verses in the Bible that you are fond of. Luke chapter 15, if you will, turn there. And I want to show you, this is one of the greatest pictures in the Bible as far as I'm concerned. If you really understand what's going on and what's going on behind the scenes. Christ has come to earth and, you know, he's God in the flesh and he has already proclaimed that, or at least he hasn't denied the fact that he was when they accused him of it. Or said, you said this. And, so they didn't expect God to come in the flesh and to do what he did. You know, God ought to seek holy men like the Pharisees and the Sadducees and those type of people to hang out with. But he didn't. He hung out with odd people. He hung out with people that took taxes from the Jewish people. And he hung out with people that had leprosy. And he hung out with people that were sick and afflicted and those that were ill and those that needed help. And that is not what God ought to do. God ought to go to the righteous and seemingly religious people. He didn't do that. They accused him of that here. And verse 1, he says, they drew near him, all the publicans and the sinners, to hear him. The Pharisees and the scribes murmured, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. We don't understand that verse because a meal in another country, and most any other country other than America, means much more than it does to us. It's kind of a mini covenant thing. Dana knows about that, I'm sure, because in Mexico, when somebody invites you to eat, you don't turn it down. You know, it's like saying, you can be my friend. And when you say, no, I don't want anything to eat, I'd rather pass. You're passing on a friendship. You don't do that. So anyway, that meant more to them than it does to us. And the Pharisees, in verse 3, and he spake to them a parable. He gives three different parables here. First of all, he gives one about a lost sheep, and we don't have the time to go into all of them. So I'm going to paraphrase them. And he gives a parable, first of all, of a lost sheep. Now, you have to understand that these parables mean, the first two ones mean, have a meaning of their own, and this last one he gives kind of combines the two of them. The first one is about monetary or value. And sometimes as Christians we feel like, you know, we don't deserve what we've got, we don't deserve who we are, and we really don't understand our position between us and God, and we feel unworthy. Now, that is, certain amount of that is merited. But after we're forgiven and you understand where God stands and how he looks at you, you shouldn't feel that way. You should be humble about it, yes, but you shouldn't feel worthless because we're not. He gives us these three parables to show us just exactly that. The first one's about a lost sheep. He says, you got 99, or you had 100, you lost one of them, and the shepherd goes after them. Now he's out somewhere and he's lost the sheep, you know. And the shepherd's going to get it. Shepherds were usually hired to take care of the flock. And generally speaking, they didn't go get the sheep because they just loved them to death. They went and got them because it was money. You know, that's what they made their living with. That's how they made their monetary means. He's going to get this sheep because it's worth something. It's valuable. You don't lose something that ain't valuable. You see, the word lost, though, he uses it three different times in these three different parables. And you have never lost anything that wasn't valuable to you. I'll give you an example. Have you ever lost a penny? I'm sure you have, but let me ask you this. Did you tear your house apart looking for it? Now, she didn't really lose it. It's just gone. It wasn't something worth looking for. Have you ever lost $100 bill? Oh, yeah, I remember that happened. Yeah, we tore the place apart. And nobody slept until we found it. Have you ever lost your wallet? Have you ever lost something so valuable that everything had to come to a halt until it was found? The sheep was that way. He left the 99 that was there. We sang a song about that. And he went to find the one that was lost. Why? It was valuable. The next parable is the same thing. This lady lost a piece of a gold coin. And it says, she called over her friends. She called in reinforcements. And we're going to tear this place apart. Why? Because she just loved that thing and she had such an attachment to it. I told you the first two had a particular point. He's painting this picture up for the Pharisees. He's baiting them in. He's pulling them in. They're like, yeah, go get it. It's worth something. Don't let it go. And he's fishing to sucker them in. And this last one, he just really pours it on. And so they tear this house apart and they find this piece of gold that this lady lost. Why? Because it was valuable. Then he gives this last parable. It's about a prodigal son, we call it. The son that left, and you know the story better than I do, I'm sure. But I want to point out some key aspects about this particular passage that tells us, first of all, we're talking about forgiveness, so it's going to point that out for us. But most of all, it tells you the worth, because he just gave those other two to show you how valuable we are. Every time that the Lord talked about those that were falling and those that he was seeing, he referred to them as the lost. Never called them sinners. Now, he called other people sinners, but he didn't call these particular people that he was dealing with, eating with, and those that he was with. He referred to them as the lost. So when he says that they're lost, he is saying, you are of such great value, I will do anything I have to do, including go to the cross and give my life for you. He did just that. So we are of utmost value. Not just us Christians, all of the creation. Everybody out there. So the people that we look down upon. You see, don't be caught in that, because that's what the Pharisees did. He stood there and he said, thank you, Lord, that I'm not like this guy right here. I'm a righteous man. He said, who went away vindicated? You see. So he began to say here in verse 11 that there was a certain man that had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, give me the portions of the good that befalls me. And he divided them amongst them. First of all, that was illegal. He couldn't do that. He shouldn't. That wasn't by law allowed, because that wasn't allowed to be done, because the law accounted for the fact that the older man, the father, was to be taken care of until he died. Now, what if he'd get his living after both of those boys and they went and blown it? He wouldn't have had enough money to even got out of his life with. So the law prohibited him from doing that, or was supposed to have, so he in essence sort of broke the law by giving him this boy this money. So he did, and he divided his fortunes. And by the way, what the boy was saying, you know, since the fact that, this wasn't supposed to be done until the father's death, he was in essence saying, you have to kind of get into this picture, because he's painting this picture for the Pharisees, and the Pharisees are sitting there listening, and they're ready to kill this boy. And you know they are. He is in essence saying, Dad, I can't wait for you to drop over dead. Won't you just give me what I need? What you're going to give me when you croak and I'm gone. That's exactly what he was saying. That's exactly what Christ meant for them to understand, and that's exactly what he meant. So he goes on to say, not many days after, he didn't wait long. He gathered all that he had together, and he took a trip into a far country and wasted his substance with riotous living. And when he spent all that he had, he arose, and a mighty famine arose, and he began to want. And he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into the fields to feed swine. Now, Christ is just getting worse and worse and worse about painting this horrible picture. Because first of all, the boy had asked his daddy to break the law, and he told him that he just couldn't wait for him to drop over dead to get what he wanted, and they're ready to choke him at this point. But now, here is a Jew in a foreign country feeding pigs. Did you know you couldn't even get close to a pig? You couldn't even touch a pig as a Jew. You were ceremonially unclean if you did. So this is just getting as bad as it can get, and Christ intentionally is doing that. He's just painting this picture just as horrible as it can be. And he's going to drop a bombshell on them just here in a second. And he goes on to say, in verse 16, when he would have fain filled his belly with the husk that the swine did eat, and no man gave him to him, he finally came to himself. this is the attitude that we have sometimes about ourselves, and you've seen people like that, and I'm sure that you know people this way, and I hope you don't feel this way for yourself, but if you do, let me give you some consolation. Do you understand what this verse is saying? This is a young Jewish man that shouldn't even be where he is. He's wasted his father's living, and he knows that. He's out feeding an animal that the Bible in Deuteronomy and Leviticus warns him and gives him instruction not to be around. He's not only breaking his father's heart, he's also breaking his religious law. When he left, he said, "Dad, I don't want anything to do with you. I don't want anything to do with your religion." Because he's out here feeding swine. You see, this is as low a state in life as you could get. Then it gets worse. He's starving to death. This young man is starving to death. And he says, he's in such bad shape, he would eat what he's feeding the pigs, but that didn't happen. So the people that he's working for, in essence, is saying, "Look, if you drop dead, we'll get somebody else to take the place. But you got to feed the pigs." You see? Can you imagine being in that state in life, and some of you may have been? This is the lowest point this boy could have got. The pigs have got to live. If you drop over dead from hunger, we'll find somebody to take your place. You see? Then he goes on. This is the state of mind that he's in. He said, when he came to his death, and he said, "How many hired servants of my father have enough bread and to spare? I'm dying with hunger." He said, "I'll rise and go to my father, and I'll say I've sinned against heaven and before him." This is that rehashing. You see, he's already making up his speech. And he starts to deliver that very speech here just in a minute. But he says, "My father has servants, and all of them are being fed." Now, there's a long story behind the hired servant there. That's not somebody that lived on the place, by the way. That was somebody that you went to the marketplace to get when you needed extra hand, like, you know, the people that travel around to help during planting season and harvesting season. That's that type of people. You get the idea that somebody's living on the place, and he's keeping them up and feeding them, and they're working there. That's not what he's talking about. All he's saying is, "Dad, I ain't worthy to be called your son. I'm not even worthy to be living on your place." He said, "But all I'm asking, I'm coming back, and when you need extra hands, and you're down there in the marketplace looking for somebody, would you just look for me? I'm going to be there. That's all I'm asking. Because I'm not worthy," and he realized that, "not worthy to be called a son." That's how we view ourselves many times before the Lord. He doesn't want us viewing ourselves that way. Doesn't mean we should be prideful and haughty, but we should understand how the Lord really looks at us and live from that standpoint. And when you do, you can accomplish things you would never have imagined otherwise. He wouldn't have given us this parable had he not meant for us to understand that in the way I just told you. So, he said, "I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Let me be one of your hired servants." In verse 20, "And he arose and came to his father. But when he was a great way off, his father saw him, and he had compassion on him, and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him." You got to realize, this boy had pig poo all over him. And he was a mess. He didn't even have shoes on. By the way, the fact that he didn't have shoes on indicated he was a slave. And we'll look at some things that happened here just in a second. "And the son said to him," he starts to rehearse this thing that he made up. He says, "I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, and I'm no more worthy to be called your son." Father cuts him off right there. He don't even get a chance to spill the rest of his story. He cuts him off right in the middle, and he says, "But the father said to the servant, bring forth a robe and put it on him, and bring a ring and put it on his hand, and shoes on his feet, and why in the world didn't they just go to the house and get it?" I want to ask you that. Think about that just for a second. You know, he's coming in. The father runs to him there and letting him come home, and he sends the servant back home to get clothes, a ring, and some shoes to bring back to put on the boy so they can take him home. Isn't that kind of crazy? Why don't we just go home and get it? God says, "When you take him home looking like that, you know, there ain't no way I'm taking my son home, and they're going to see pig poop on him. They're going to see the fact that he ain't got no shoes on, which means he's been a slave, and we ain't taking him home like that. He's going to go over here behind a rock, and we're going to fix him up, and he's going to go like my son when he goes home." That's why he does that. That's what he does to us. He cleans us up. We don't clean ourselves up, but he dresses us up, and he presents us before the heavenly host cleansed. And that's what he's trying to tell us here. And then he goes on. He says, And bring the fatted calf and kill it and let us eat and make merry. By the way, the ring was really a signet. It wasn't just something to piece of jewelry like we wear today. It was a signet ring which, you know, the father had just given everything the boy would ever have. And he just wasted all of it. So he didn't have any money. And he realized that. And he wouldn't have any credit because he blew everything he had. So he gave him a signet ring. And a signet ring was his father's ring, which he would put in wax and would show that he owed a debt. And his father was going to take care of it. That sounds familiar to you? Yeah, we owe a debt that we're not going to be able to pay either. It's paid by our father. Same analogies go through. It's one of the most beautiful, in my eyes, one of the most beautiful stories in the Bible. And then he says, this was my son who was dead. We're dead in sin. We rise out of it and alive again. And he was lost and is found. He's so important. We're glad we got him back. And they began to be merry. And we've out of time, far out of time, so not going to go on. But you know the other story. You get to see the other brother that was really the one that hated his father from the beginning. He said, "You, I have slaved for you all these years. All these years." The Bible says work. You look it up in the Greek. And the boy really said, "I have slaved all these years. I have worked myself to the bone for you. If I ever got a fatty cat," you know what the father said? "Think back," he said. "Remember when I parted all this stuff out and gave the younger boy a third, which would have been the part he would have got?" He says, "Everything else is yours. It's all yours. I'm living on your stuff." He said, "You could have had a fatty cash every day if that's what you wanted." We just don't understand sometimes where we stand in the Lord. We don't understand our position. We don't understand how God looks at us. And we don't understand what true vindication is and the fact that God has bought and paid for our sin. And we live from a crowd standpoint. We live from not an humble standpoint, but a crawling standpoint. Now, you got to understand, I don't mean that we shouldn't reverence God and that we shouldn't pay homage and we shouldn't respect who He is and who we are. But I'm telling you, when He tells us that we should look at ourselves sometimes the way we do, Satan tells us that. Satan tells us that we are unworthy to be God's people. We are unworthy because of the thoughts that go through our head and the things that we think. And that we'll never be any better than we are, and we might as well get it up. And when you live from that standpoint, you're not going to accomplish much. When you live from the standpoint that God loves me so much that He don't want to present me before other people, spiritually speaking, unclean. That He dresses me up before He takes me home. Isn't that a wonderful thought? Isn't that the best picture you can get of how God loves us? We're so important. We mean so much to Him that when we're lost, He has done everything that He can to get us back. And the choice from that point is ours. And it's solely ours. That's the scary part. I wish God would just make me do exactly what I needed to do. That would be nice, wouldn't it? But that wouldn't be love. That would be force. That's a whole different issue, isn't it? See, I can make my children do what I want them to because they're under my rule. I must let them do it because they love me. You see, that's the difference. You can't make somebody do something. You can't make somebody obey the gospel. You can tell them, you can teach them, and you can do all that you can. But you can't make them. It's a choice. And even if you force them and coerce them and they do it, and they don't mean it, it still hasn't meant nothing, has it? And they're going to live from that standpoint in life of who they think they are rather than who they really are. So, my prayer is for you that you learn and study and come to grips with who God views you and how He views you. And when you can get that down, I think, man, you're going to live like you're the king, son of a king. That's what He wants us to do. And we'll be happy. We'll understand. We'll get along with people. We'll get in better relationships. And we'll understand that everything God wants us to do is for our benefit. And when He asks us to do something, it's not for our hardship. He's not trying to trip us for something that is beneficial. He's trying to add it to us. And when He asks us to forgive, and He tells us how to do that, it's for our benefit. He don't want us to live in with those thoughts and those harboring those feelings and thinking about that every time we wake up and every time we go to bed. He doesn't want us thinking like that. He says, get rid of it as quickly as you can, and you'll have far less problems as a result of it. Again, this is my last night, and I certainly appreciate the fact of being here. You've been a very patient audience, and we went way long tonight, so apologize for that. Appreciate your patience. And as we close, if we can help you start your way to forgiveness, because many times in life it certainly is easier. It's more pleasing, at least in the flesh, to be able to pursue a life of revenge for ourselves. You know, the victory is in the Spirit. And sometimes that's not good enough for us. We want to see something happen. And just to overcome in our spirit and to be able to gain victory in our spirit, not satisfying enough, because we just don't want to turn loose of what we've got to be able to pay somebody back. We just can't do that. We just can't live with that. It's a hard thing to do. We feel like we can't live with that. The problem is we really can't live with it. You can't live at all. Not like what God wants you to. If we can help to turn your life around this season, if we can ask to add you to the body, Lord has called us. This is the most wonderful. This is not talking necessarily to Christians, by the way. With what we just read about the prodigal son. This is a lost condition. This is the way of the world. That son represents all of humanity. Every single person that's ever been created, that son represents it. God welcomes them back, longs for them to come back, is seeking constantly them, trying to get them back. Why do you think he gave you the two about the lost and how important they were just before that? It's to prepare your mind for the fact that we are valuable and he wants us back. That's why we call you to repentance. That's why we call you to baptism, because you've got a God that loves you so much. He died for you, and I hate to see you waste that. So we've got a song for your convenience. We'd ask that you come while we stand in prayer.
Oh, do not let the word be.